So, in the general themes that I wanted to talk about, well, I mean, the general theme of these lectures has been an idea that religion is one of the things that religion is about a quest for meaning, if you like. It's about the search for meaning. There's an impulse towards meaning, that human beings are meaning-seeking and meaning-creating animals, and that this is fundamental to the formation of religions. Secondly, there's my view, what's central to the notion of to the understanding of religion, and what characterizes it. Hello, what characterizes it from other kinds of institutions and so on. If you sit there, I can have one. Oh, okay.
Okay, thank you. Sit on the other one.
You sit on
Changed
that.
ends. No, that's okay.
Okay.
There's a chair I've turned, but never mind. It's difficult to get
It's
it out.
difficult to get it out now, yeah.
I'm sorry to be late.
That's all right.
I was
We
early
just
half an
started.
hour ago, and then I was late.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm just
Thank
saying
you.
that
That's very kind, please.
I'm not going to give a formal lecture because my computer broke, and so the lecture was
Oh,
on that, so I pulled some pictures off of the internet.
yes.
So just to review, one of the themes of these talks has been that human beings are fundamentally meaning-seeking creatures. We create meanings, and that there's an urge in us, an impulse towards meaning. Secondly, religions, I think, if any religions are about anything, they're about transcendence of some kind, some sort of transcendence of the human condition, looking towards something outside of the universe, as it were, pointing towards that. But I mean, that's open to debate. Anyway, I've talked about that in previous weeks. So that's why, in my view, football isn't about religion. Or, well, anyway, we can discuss that. And the third thing I think that religions are about is about developing an intensification of certain kinds of inwardness or subjectivity. And that's not to be confused with individuality. So I don't think religions are about individuality at all, but they are about certain kinds of subjectivity or inwardness that are cultivated in specific, in tradition-specific ways. And then, was it last week or the week before, we talked about the variable indexicality, and the way that sort of process happens with the help of linguistic anthropology. So today I was going to talk about the way this plays, those ideas play out in religious art, and I will talk about that a bit, but I'm going to show you a sort of slideshow of religious art, so you can curl up at the back and fall asleep, or I hope you don't, but it's not the afternoon, so you should be able to manage to stay awake. And it raises various questions about, well, what is religion? What is religious art? What's the force of that adjective religious? Is it appropriate at all to use that the term? So I think looking at art does raise fundamental questions about the nature of religion, and the nature of human meaning and so on. So I thought we'd start way back, 3,500 BC, over 5,000 years ago, with Paleolithic cave art. This is the wonderful cave paintings in Altamira. Many of you probably know more about this than I do, but it's, well, these of course are quite deep, hidden in the caves, and they were discovered in the 20th century by various people. And it was a shock, of course. They thought that these were fairly modern, but then they find that they're 3,500 BC, so over 5,000 years old. And they're paintings of animals, and they're overlaid on top of each other, so it's quite interesting. There didn't seem to be much concern for the space of the things, but more the drawing of them. But they're drawn with such incredible accuracy and stunning beauty. And here's two rhinoceroses fighting each other. So this is our earliest kind of art, I suppose. And these are horses, early horses, incredible accuracy and beauty, really.
Especially considering it was dark and they'd been doing it now.
That's right.
Sort of artificial lamp flickering.
That's right. Yeah, it was just a wick or something on a lamp, artificial lamp. Stunning. It's dark and smelly in those caves. And they must have had, I mean, before they were allowed to go on the wall like that, I guess these people must have developed these skills in other ways, through sketching on wood or something on the ground. And there we are, but there's a bison. Now, is this religious art, or is it, I mean, presumably, if it's along the lines that I've been thinking, it's about the search for meaning and understanding, then I probably is religious art in some sense, but many the theories have been put forward that they're the sort of magical depictions in order to be successful in hunting, and it could well be part of that, could well be true.
There's an overlap, according to people, that phrase, between magic and religion.
Yeah. It's like, where does magic
end
and
religion
begin?
Yeah.
I myself wouldn't go in for an evolutionary kind of thing, but certainly lots of religion is magical in a sense. It wants to affect the world in some way. So, and these are lions. I mean, this is something that I was thinking that the seems to go against that thesis, that if they paint bison and horses and aurochs on the cave walls because they want to be successful in hunting, why paint lions? Because you don't hunt lions. I don't think they hunted lions.
Maybe something to do with them hunting you.
Yes, to stop them hunting you. Yes, that's right. It could be that. But again, with such beauty and accuracy. And here's another one with aurochs, those ancient cattle, and rhinoceroses, and horses. You can see a row of horses on the right. And two animals fighting each other, two aurochs or bison bashing into each other in the bottom right hand. But it makes you quite. I mean, I don't think there's development in art. I mean, this is just as good as anything. And. Notion of subjectivity from, 5,000-year-old subjectivity coming into view here, I think. Someone's hand, a handprint. So they would put the hand on the cave wall, and they used to have a mouthful of paint and blow the paint onto the wall to leave the outline of the hand. And some of them had missing fingers. That's a sort of an offering of some kind, perhaps, who knows. But anyway, the signature of the person who did this all those years ago. Very few human representations, but here's one of a man evidently being. What's happening? Is he being attacked by a bison? Is he collapsing? Because the bison itself is wounded. It seems to be disemboweled on the right hand side there, with a broken spear. And this object, this bird on a stick, is very interesting. I did read somewhere that was in a stick with a bird on the top of it was a shamanic symbol, I read, perhaps in Iliada, a book on shamanism. I'm afraid I didn't have time to check that out. But completely mysterious. Is this about some sort of symbiotic relationship between the human and the animal? Is this man in a state of possession from the spirit of the animal? And lastly, the very famous Les Trois Frères cave. This composite figure of, well, what is it? Is it a human being dressed up as an animal? Is it an animal human? But certainly indicative of some sort of belief in a supernatural agency of some kind. Or
and what's the year?
3500 BC.
This as well?
Yeah, this one too. Yeah. Les Trois Frères. Paleolithic. Very, very ancient. Is it somebody dressed up with antler horns on, to hunt? Because we know that the early hunting communities did put deer skulls on their heads and to go hunting.
It's beginning to show an interest in internal anatomy too.
Ah, yes, indeed, ribs. Yeah.
Nice little bit of kneecap.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's like a skeleton. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that's an amazing picture, isn't it? Oh, there we are. So so that's Paleolithic, and then this is
not
a very
not
subjective
too much,
yeah. History. Huh? Moving forward 5,000 years.
Sorry, were they all in one particular cave?
No, they're all in France, but this is Les Trois Frères, Altamira. Altamira is in Spain, northern Spain. It's in the Pyrenees region. But this is in central France, Les Trois Frères. But I mean, they were only right down deep inside the caves, but it could have been, of course, that all of the caves were painted. They just got worn away with weathering. But one would like to think that there was something symbolic and important about the depth of the caves, because they're terribly difficult to access. This is why they've been so well preserved and discovered by accident. You know, dogs falling down holes and things like that.
It's interesting that we haven't got anything like it, as far as I know, from Africa, where it's very much a diversity of cultures,
yeah,
of course, but and there are mountainous regions where we might have
there's a Atlas Mountains, they've got
yes
cave paintings.
Well, they
have. Mm, the Atlas Mountains. But they're not as old as this,
no,
they're much
no
more recent.
No.
But nowhere in South America, as far as I know, either. Hey, Chris. Do you want to grab a chair? I'll get one
yes
from my room if you like. well, religious art, moving on to a completely different continent in the 20th century. Here's a representation of Shiva, which again, I mean, the theme of this is the encounter of humanity with some, or the representation of some divine force or some transcendent power. And this is simply something that I like. there's Shiva with his matted locks and his third eye of wisdom. And again, you sometimes read Eliade, which I'm not that unsympathetic to, that there are echoes of sort of shamanic kind of ideas in the iconography of Shiva, Lord of Snakes. And the half moon in his hair could echo the earlier Indus Valley seal of a seated god with horns. So it could be an echo of a horned god there. And the tiger skin, indeed.
Which might be one reason why you would hunt it.
Yeah. To get the skin power over the animal.
And many say Shiva stems from the Madhavasi god.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Not very
deep. Yeah, not very deep. Yeah, that's right. So he's on in the Vedas. He's on the edges of Aryan community,
yeah,
and he could have his origins in the Indus Valley. And again, Durga, a representation Otto called it numinous. I know it's not very fashionable to use Otto and so on, but I think that, I mean, there is something to Otto's idea that there is an encounter of humanity with something outside of themselves, numinous power, which is terrible and awful and ferocious, as well as good and benign.
He is very important in talking about the visual arts as expressing and evoking numinous, when a lot of other scholars,
yes,
you know, didn't ever think of anything except words.
Yes,
didn't think
right
of visual text.
Yeah.
So I think it's still important in that amazing collection he began, which still continues in the old Chancellery of Marburg.
I didn't know about that.
It's a museum of the visual arts, which started with his own collection in his travels and then continued to add to. It's an amazing. His archives are there as well.
Right.
Where it's the visual art, which is probably the most distinctive in the world.
I didn't know that. So, and of course, the more extreme form is in Kali. There she is, in the corpse of her husband, Shiva. I mean, it defies explanation, really, and a precise explanation, a one-to-one kind of. This is a symbol of, and this represents this. It's a composite image, and it's not necessarily. It's interesting that a lot of Indian art, I don't think, is necessarily linked to narrative. It stands alone.
Mm.
It was Lessing's idea that you have to have narrative to understand a work of art. You have to have narrative, like in that book, Lao Kaon. You can't understand that without the story. But a lot of Indian art, it seems to me, stands independently of narrative.
Doesn't the narrative help decipher like what are in each of the four hands? Being able to place
it in I suppose it does. Yeah. I mean, what is the story behind this, the mythology? She's dancing on the corpse of her husband. She's in a cremation ground. I mean, each of the things you can say, that represents, say, the Shiva's trident represents the creation and maintenance and destruction of the universe, that kind of thing.
The potential power of the female figure when independent of the male,
yeah.
The extent of dwelling in.
That's right, yeah. Yes, so you can read those kinds of themes in it. But I suppose, in fact, there is a narrative, don't you? The story of Kali, where does she come from? She comes out of the brow of Durga, the sweat of Durga, if I remember, when the demons get too much. I don't remember the specific the mythology, I'm afraid. I'm not very good at remembering the mythology.
Like all good things, they are plural anyway.
Yes, yes.
There are many stories in that.
Indeed.
Many different versions of even the same story.
Indeed. It resists just one explanation. Mm. And the gentle side of the goddess, Sarasvati,
the fluffy,
very beautiful goddess of music, learning. Again, independent of a male god.
Could multiple limbs kind of project the omnipotence of the
yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And then moving on to a different world. This is a Gandhara Buddha from the 5th century. But Buddhist art is interesting, I think, because it conveys, the whole culture is based on this inner experience, this inward experience of the character called the Buddha, and it's conveyed in these kinds of artistic representations. So in a sense, the experience of the Buddha spawns a whole culture, a whole civilization. The inward, a particular kind of inwardness, which isn't individuality, but it's certainly an intensification of a subjective state.
There's a great influence in style in Gandhara.
Yeah, there is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Greek kingdoms there. That's you can see the Greek clothing now, the folds.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one in Hong Kong, the modern one.
Mm-hmm.
It's
huge, isn't it?
It's huge. Yeah, just the sheer size of these things.
Mm.
Like the huge ones in Afghanistan, we got blown up, unfortunately.
Mm.
And moving on to China again.
With a face that reflects the culture.
With a face
so
that reflects the culture.
The Buddha is for China, the Buddha is for Korea, the Buddha doesn't have to be historically grounded.
No. Mm-hmm. That's right, it doesn't have to be historically grounded, he's adaptable. Different cultures, and here's with divine beings around the bodhisattvas, and here's the Buddha as a protecting deity in a Chinese temple. And moving on to a completely different world, where there's no representations of human. Well, there are in Persia, but do we have any Arabic? So I think this is La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammad Rasul Allah. There's no God but God, and Muhammad is a messenger of God. Good old beautiful calligraphy. So I've taken those as exemplars of Islamic art, really.
And sometimes Arabic speakers can't unravel the actual letters and words from something
right.
Which has become just a beautiful form.
Pure abstract,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is modern, this is 20th century.
So is the Islamic world, do you ever see portraits or...
In Persia you do, but you're not supposed to.
Mughal
India, yeah.
Portraits of emperors
yeah.
And things, but it's not generally.
Not generally.
Certainly not of the prophet, unless his face is blank in those cultures which have
Yeah.
Does their idea of idolatry go to just regular people as well?
No.
I mean, do you see it?
Mm-hmm. Not in mainstream Arabic art. But you don't on the edges of that influence, I think.
We had some Muslim families when I was in Lancaster from a rural part of India who wouldn't even allow their children to have the annual school photograph, which, you know, if then displayed on mantelpieces, which is what most of us did, would potentially be idolatrous. And they didn't have televisions either. But that, those examples, I think, will vary a lot. But those particular families. But they were happy that their children dressed up and were Joseph and Mary, etc., in the nativity play.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the photos are completely out. As well. Mm.
I'm moving on to a different continent, Africa, which... No, I mean, is this religious art? These are reliquaries, by the way. These are for reliquaries for ancestors. So, after a second, you'd get your ancestors' bones and put them in this.
And there's a police one before you do.
Hmm?
There's a police one before you do. The same. More. Hmm?
Yes.
Whatever it was, I used to say.
So this is a Kora culture on the West Africa, Niger. This is 19th century. Because the French banned these things in the 20th century. Another one. This looks so strange, this one.
Mm.
I think this one's clay, the other one was wood. But, now is this religious art? This is a good question. In a sense, it's easy. I mean, when you look at the history of art and Christianity, you say, well, this is religious art, this is not religious art, because you've got representation from the Bible and so on. But is the word religion or religious actually appropriate in some other traditions and some other cultures? Is it appropriate to look at Paleolithic art in terms of religion? Or indeed, in terms of these ancestor images in terms of religion? It's a question we can discuss presently. And moving on to a different medieval world in the West, here's Christ in Hagia Sophia. And this is prototypical religious art. The religious art would be for something like this. Has anyone been there?
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is that the halo, is that meant to be the representation of the aura?
That's their outside of Christianity as well. Sometimes it's linked with the sun.
That's right.
So you've got the
sun,
light, and it's the sunlight usually in Christianity, is it not? The moon light.
That's
interesting. You see Apollo, for example, and
exactly.
Aphrodite becomes the Virgin Mary,
exactly.
Which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
And then Apollo becomes a male figure.
There's some interesting examples in the world of late antiquity, that book I've got, Peter Brown, where he shows the Egyptian Isis and Osiris, and then a Coptic mother and child.
Right.
And it's exactly the same form, except in the Coptic Christian one, there are little crosses, and she's much more modestly dressed, the Virgin.
Yeah. Well, just to get that halo image, don't you, across different cultures, I suppose, just I don't know if it's an aura or what. I remember reading a book on Kirlian photography once. You ever heard of that? Kirlian photography? There's some Russian character developed some special kind of electronic, I can't remember what it was.
Supposed to photograph one's electrical field.
Yeah, electrical around the body, that's right.
Yeah.
So they're very interesting. So you cut a leaf in half and photograph the leaf. You still have the outline of the leaf from this electrical field around the leaf. Interesting. And the rays of light coming out from the skin. So that's a representation of that, I don't know.
Interesting thing about icons, they're supposed to be painted under very special conditions, and they're kind of interactive with the beholder.
Yeah.
And I mean, they've got things like distorted perspective,
yeah,
and altered sense of time. And I think there's some idea that they kind of not just depict a narrative expression of, you know, biblical events or whatever, but they actually induce the experience, the first-hand experience of them.
Yeah. Windows into heaven. So
yeah.
He's an imperial dark blue purple, isn't he? So he's represented
the king.
As if he's emperor.
I knew he was famous Da Vinci. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that say the icon is supposed to induce the same state as the creator of it.
Mm.
Is that
yes, no, that was the shorthand. But I don't think there isn't a hard line. I don't think there's any line between religious and non-religious.
Mm.
Right.
Leonardo or anything else.
So, well, here we are, Leonardo, but the figure on the left, John, so that wasn't it the book made a big fuss, this is Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and Jesus says, in my opinion, his relationship with John is quite ambiguous in terms of the relationship there, and in the book of John is Mary Magdalene, because Mary Magdalene, I don't see her as being a prostitute at all. I can see where he gets it, and she does, and John does look like quite a woman.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. But and of course here we are, Michelangelo, is it Christian cosmology depicted? Final judgment and everyone going off downstairs, down below. Yeah. Fantastic, Sistine Chapel. And the creation of Adam. Again, I pulled this one off of the web because of this connection between the human and the notion of transcendence and the depictions of transcendence.
And some people suggest that what's meant by the image of God in the human being is the human being's capacity for creativity, not least in being him or herself an artist.
Right.
Well, in the Genesis account, when the human being is made in the image of God,
that
sort of debate about what was that. You know, I mean, here it's we look a bit the same. So at least the chap does. But you know, the more subtle kind of reflections is it that human beings have this capacity for creativity?
Yes.
But obviously, that story is indicating God has.
Right.
And of course, being artists. Is one of the greatest forms of creativity, but also perhaps being engineers or whatever else we do to create.
Right, and you get that reversed, and you get the arguments for God as a creator, as an artist.
Then that image is supposed to have been marred at the fall, and then gets restored in the Christian understanding of things with Jesus.
That's right, the restoration of that. So there we are, there's the Michelangelo.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is the same theme with the creation of Adam, God creating Adam, William Blake.
Mm-hmm.
It must be about 1760 or something, I suppose. It's quite a stunning.
Mm-hmm.
You could feel the weight of God on your chest.
Ancient of days.
Ancient of days, yes. Again, a sense of awe, really, and power coming through.
And the snake's already there. Almost as if it's coming out of Adam's ribs. Because,
yes.
You know, is that the horrible theological thing that's been made with woman on this snake?
Yes.
Because she's made out of a rib, according to the story.
That's right, and the snake seems to be coming out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Adam doesn't look very happy, does he?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no.
Something out of aliens, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
It's more like a court, really.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that God's got wings there, like
yes,
an archangel.
Yeah.
That's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. You get the icon, Rubelev's icon of the Trinity.
Mm.
I suppose it's the nearest thing where
yeah,
God's got
the
wings.
Angels,
the angels. Yeah. What we've got. Ah, sorry.
It also looks like part of nature somehow.
God does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Storm.
Wind. Yeah.
Wind and storm. <such ideas. laughs>
No. The green man.
Yeah.
Green man. That's right.
Yes.
That's
yeah.
Yeah. All these echoes. Interesting. And then Satan. So we had a numinous, terrifying power before, and here again, Blake's version. He doesn't look particularly evil, but he certainly looks powerful.
And is it in the Coventry? Big, I think it's Epstein, is it, outside in the new Coventry Cathedral, where the face of Satan meets the face of who St. Michael is defeating in the statue. The face of St. Michael and the face of Satan are actually the same.
Ah.
Oh,
that's interesting.
As if there's a defeat
that.
Of something within because he is a fallen angel, isn't he?
Because he's a fallen angel.
Sense which the archangel and the fallen angel.
Yeah.
In some strange way. Here.
And he's got an orb. He's a king here, isn't
yeah,
he? He's got an orb.
Very beautiful, actually.
Mm. Yeah, very beautiful.
Perhaps that's why it's so dangerous.
Yeah.
The an interesting thing in terms of Blake's terminology, too, is that he wanted to say, was this innocence or experience? You'd say innocence, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would, actually. Yeah.
I would say temptation.
Mm.
Temptation.
It's beautiful. You know, there's riches and nothing against the, you know, what makes you fall into the hands of the devil is temptation and beauty.
He dresses himself as the angel of light.
That's right.
Mm.
Yeah. But that's a trap in a way. You're stuck. The darker side to it. You know, visionary. And another, here we've got a Jewish Christ, Chagall, reclaiming Jesus, really, I always think of this.
Yeah, people say there's two ways of looking at that. You know, the figure in the Jewish refugees in the boat,
yeah.
pointing back.
Yeah.
Some people say that's an identification of Jesus as a Jewish Christ, obviously with a talit as a loincloth.
Yes.
But others say, actually, when you think of the Christian anti-Semitism of Europe that many see laid the way for Hitler.
Yes.
But because it's 1938, is it?
About
1938,
this one, yeah.
This, you know, that actually it's an accusatory pointing, but it's in the name of this figure.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Paradoxically,
yeah.
that now, you know, the refugee with the sack people with the scrolls of the Torah. And the only thing that's not askew
yeah.
is actually the menorah, which is the only thing that's burning steady
yes.
at the bottom.
Oh, yes.
Everything else is in chaos, with the ancestors covering their eyes.
Yes, that's right.
Synagogues burning.
And the Red Army or something. On the
and that pointing might, as much as identity, be
accusation.
Never left us with details to tell us what
yeah.
he is. Maybe a bit of a
that's very interesting, yeah. I didn't.
Mm.
I wasn't aware of that alternative reading, but you can certainly have this in there. Yeah. Well, that's suffering.
He's also lit by the candle.
He is
yes.
lit by the candle.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And also a ray of light coming down from above by
mm-hmm.
the look of it.
Mm-hmm. Seem to be kind of connected. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's got a halo as well, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And this is a later Christ by Chagall again. This is 1966. This is Exodus. This is called Exodus.
Mm.
You do. I do wonder if he's just sort of milking it a bit now. You know, it's 1967.
But it's unusual, isn't it, for a culturally Jewish artist, for a culturally Jewish person to paint visual arts?
Yeah.
Because the same as for Muslims, you know, there is actually a bit of a barrier to that. If you're going to be an artist, then you would use calligraphy, Torah scrolls, etc.
Yes.
Not this kind of representation of art.
Yes.
And in Han Potok's My Name is Asher Lave, some people think that the hero of that, where there's this sort of ambiguity, is actually based on Chagall.
So anyway, the same theme's coming up here, the burning buildings and the beautiful bride on the right and floating along. And a community of people here, Exodus, Christ hovering over them, for good or for ill.
Mother and child in the foreground.
Mother and child in the foreground, yes.
The dog will go for work.
I don't know what this person is doing with the child in the bottom there. Is it? Picking the child up or laying it down. It's not unhappy, this painting, is it? Some of the people seem quite happy. George Ruel, died 1957, French Catholic painter. Again, very striking, stunning representations of Christ. It's quite a famous one. Looks like it could be a stamp, doesn't it?
You didn't include Jane art.
No.
But that definitely reminds me of the figures in a Jane temple.
Well, this one does.
Yes. With the emphasis on drawing you into the eyes.
You're drawn into the eyes here.
I think there might be a sort of prostitute painted face. As the fool, the clown, and the prostitute. Somehow may be part of the inspiration.
Right. So he's. Shock.
Yes.
Anyone know what this is?
Piss Christ.
Yeah, Piss Christ.
Yeah.
What?
Serrano.
Piss
Christ. 1987. I think it's kind of beautiful, but it's. It's a it's a crucifix and a glass of the artist's urine.
What? Really?
Yeah.
And how did they get the colours?
I don't know how he did it.
It's unfortunate about that, because then it becomes sort of sacrilegious to some people. But it's really beautiful.
I think it's a beautiful image. But it was very shocking in 1987.
It's far more of a representation of what Golgotha would have been like than something that's just aesthetically beautiful, because after all, crucifixion must have been horrible.
Yeah.
People probably did urinate on figures that were being executed.
Who's the artist?
Serrano, Andre Serrano. This is Latin origins, but an American. And I was going to bring along a video by him to get along with it. It was, and here's Bill Viola, another. So if Serrano is dealing with kind of transcendence in some sense, and also looking and but bringing it down to earth in a very earthy kind of way, and raising, I think he's trying to shock as well as a shock element, but still religious art, I would claim, in some sense. And then you get Bill Viola, the video artist. Again, dealing with very similar, dealing with themes of transcendence, I would say it's Viola as a religious artist, and who deals with themes of death and resurrection, mainly with drowning, because he was nearly drowned as a kid, and was brought back to life. And most of his work is focused on this event, this kind of near-death experience. So these are just stills from his video work. That's next time I'll show you one of these videos. Anyone seen Bill Viola's work? No. Some of it's a bit like watching paint dry, like you go out into the desert and film herds of cattle. But a lot of it is about drowning and resurrection and rebirth. He's very controversial because he filmed his mother dying. And, there was a big controversy about that.
What year was it?
It's about 1995.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because dying is not very often now a private affair anyway. Most people die in public places, hospitals. So actually, it's a very public thing, dying. It's just not like just being in your own family. But still, people were upset.
Well, yeah, they were, yeah. It's a very powerful film. And he also, with his son being born, he juxtaposes it with his son being born. It's an interesting video. And there he is, because he's the subject. I don't know how he does it, but he's always felt himself diving in. And some of them, he's a figure. I mean, he must hold his breath. I don't know how he does it, but he's just so still for several minutes, just turning around in the water. He looks completely drowned and dead. But, there he is, Bill Viola. Oh yeah, another one. Five Angels. It's called Five Angels. It's from. There's no words. They're just images. But he's an artist very much concerned with death, with resurrection, and the power of some other power coming into us. So, in my books, I think he's a religious artist. There's another one, Gary Nauman, who's the same generation, does similar kind of work, but completely secularized, completely without this transcendent dimension in it. Emma Kwan, light, kind of transcendent image, I think. And lastly, another sense of transcendence here, but in a very different way, Paul Klee's Novus Angelus, New Angel, which has been famously interpreted by Walter Benjamin, who bought this painting with his last savings. My wife got rid of the cross. And spent the last money on a Paul Klee painting. And he wrote that essay, The Philosophy of History, in which he based on this painting, in which Walter Benjamin's interpretation is that this is an angel of history and it's being blown backwards into the future. So the wind of modernity is blowing the angel into the future, but the angel is trying to get back into the past to heal the things that have been broken, says Benjamin. But the angel can't get back into the past because the wind of modernity is blowing too strong. And so it's blowing relentlessly into the future, although it's a tragic sense of history. So the angel is trying to get back into the past to heal the things that have been broken. And so there's a sense here of transcendence of the human condition, but it's not a kind of otherworldly transcendence, it's purely material transcendence. History is bigger than us.
She looks as if she's got her hair in colour.
Oh, I've never thought of it as a she. No. Do you think it's a she? It's an angel.
They're sexless, aren't they, angels? So there's no reason why we shouldn't be a she.
Are they sexless angels?
They're beyond. No. In heaven, there is no marriage or giving in marriage, and the angels are beyond male and female.
Oh, I see.
As is God, one hopes.
Yeah, before male. Yeah. So, anyway, that's.
It's not got trousers on, has it?
No, it is true. And the wings are kind of the arms of the wings. But Klee did a series of them. But Walter Benjamin, I think he had it with him. You know, he sadly shot himself on the border going into Spain because they closed the border for 2 days. So he couldn't get out of France. And then he killed himself.
Did he leave his wife the picture so she could recover the money?
Well, one would hope so. I think he had it with him.
Oh, so somebody stole it.
Somebody stole it. So, I'm sorry I didn't have a proper lecture to give you today. But that was due to the computer being lost and a coherent argument was lost with it. So I have to redo all that. But what I've tried to this morning to show you is just my purely subjective history of religious art. Trying to show the links between, and conveying this idea of transcendence, the link between humans and transcendence. That I've tried to express that in art. And also, I think, an intensification of a sense of subjectivity in some of these representations. So if religion is anything, to me, it's about transcendence and a sense of intensification of subjectivity.
You very carefully, probably wisely, because it's even more problematic a word, probably, than religion, avoided talking about any of it as possibly spiritual rather than religious. I mean, if there isn't an explicit religious theme,
right,
then can we still say it's spiritual because it takes us into question the existence?
I'd be happy with that.
You don't mind that?
I don't mind that. I do avoid it a bit, actually.
It is a dogma.
Yeah. Mm. I wouldn't mind what you just said.
Yeah. I think that's how some people use the term.
Yeah. You get to say we're spiritual, we're not religious. I guess like Bill Viola's representations. I mean, I'd be happy to use that with those, really. They're spiritual, but not. I mean, he's not so explicitly religious, but he's certainly dealing with very deep human themes: death, birth, possibility of change and transformation in human life.
You're still fairly loose with your use of the term transcendence, aren't you? Because sometimes you do add immaterial or beyond this universe, and then most of the rest of the time you don't.
Yeah,
I agree with you the second time, not the first.
So which one do you agree with?
The concept of transcendence,
yeah,
is not necessarily supernatural.
That's right. I agree with that. Yeah. So I always think of that Hal Clay's New Angels, an example of that, or also bringing in a sense of history.
When you go into a cave where you live after you've been out in the open as an early human being, isn't the evolution of memory and recall, which previous animals also had, of course, is that not so heightened that what you do is to play out the film that's still running in your brain, in what you do on the wall, is that possibly what we always do?
And that's what this artist is doing, isn't it?
Yeah, he's rerunning, that's right. He's rerunning his experience.
And overcoming his trauma. I mean, he's very wonderfully, he can dive into water, having been drowned. So he's doing something similar.
Yeah. It's a transformation of experience into art, I suppose, isn't it?
I'd like to see us exploring, well, I think you've possibly read my article, I'd like to see us exploring the extent to which what we call art and science and religion are all actually emergent properties of evolution.
Yes.
Of physical evolution.
It might be a bit like going into a dream, going into a cave and then reliving one's memory on the cave wall, it's with going to sleep and reliving one's memory through dreams.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
And in that dark intensification, you can see it almost.
Yeah, or superimposed images. I think.
So that was instead of a lecture. It does raise interesting questions. What is art? What is religion? What's religious art as opposed to not religious art?
When you said right at the beginning that you don't think football is a religion, I mean, is there a sense in which for some people, football becomes what they call a quasi-religion. And I know, appreciate what you're saying, but that for some people this is instead of religion, this is like Maoism, and what we've used as examples before, this has the same function of religion as religion in their mind.
I've
got a sociologist friend who's identifying posters with slogans and things, which in that sense use all the imagery and the focus of religious ideas for footballers.
Right.
So, for them it is functionally as if a religion, even if we have to say quasi-religion using that kind of
right.
terminology.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you probably could then.
Could you expand a bit more on intensification of subjectivity? Religionness.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of religions, I think, are about inner experience. I hesitate to use that word experience, but some sort of subjective state that tries to. So those shamanic pictures we looked at were a representation of some inner state or subjective world. But the subjectivity, I don't think, is individuality. It's because that's individuality is a modern notion that's grown up in the history of. The West, but certainly a subjectivity is at the heart of any religious tradition. And intensification, some kinds of art, some art seems to intensify, concentrate, illuminate, underline, highlight something like that, a sense of subjectivity, and convey it effectively. So Roald's Christ face. Seems to convey a sense of subjectivity in a way that some other art doesn't. It's a judgment.
Do you think there might be some sort of connection between art therapy and some sort of intensification of subjective experience and religious art as well?
Indeed. Again, linked with meaning. Again, the search for meaning.
It's a whole field where people can uncover and come to terms with kind of interior troubling issues and things like that.
Yeah, through art therapy. That's right.
And paradoxically, but I think actually it is the same thing, it's the search for a feeling of oneness with all things, isn't it? So you're looking deeper in and it's blossoming right out all at the same time.
Right. That would be a monistic view. That would be an inviting view. Yeah.
It certainly would, but it occurs all over as well.
Yeah. Sense of deeper connection with the world.
That's certainly what the Buddhist idea of interconnectedness
and
loss of self.
Almost everybody that has what they describes religious experiences does that one, in fact, don't they? It seemed to me that the whole universe turned inside out. Well, that's the. Anyway, and there was I.
And to the gentleman's point about art therapy, I know a couple of art therapists, and one of the ideas is that children don't have much of a command of vocabulary, but they are born with artistic expression, and they can express through, hard movements or whatever. And I think part of that, when I was looking at the cave paintings, I was wondering if it couldn't have been some also, in addition to artistic expression, sort of a way of strategizing, like there are a lot of buffalo there.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say that yet. But there are some also lions, they're bad guys, and we have to think about how we're going to take advantage of the situation. But they just, if you don't have a great command of language and people are still working that out.
That's a good point. I was thinking that some talk of connections between children's art and icons that supposed to represent some kind of not primitive but early stage of development of kind of aesthetic appreciation in children is actually depicted in icons like elongated limbs and enlarged eyes and things like that. There's supposed to be parallels there, and my understanding is it's. It enables one to re-experience one's child's appreciation of biblical events, with a kind of sense of innocence and openness and heightened awareness and things like that. The children have it.
I'm sure these things come into play. I mean, I don't know about language. Presumably, people who painted these had language. I just don't know. Anyway, we've got to
they would have had some.
I would have thought so.
Thanks
everyone for your that's the last one, but we're going to have three more next term. But thank you for coming, everybody.